Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, a widely anticipated meeting between Muslim and Catholic scholars begins in Rome, and the world holds its breath as Americans vote in presidential elections that could shape the face of future generations. A highly anticipated three-day meeting between Muslim and Catholic scholars began Tuesday at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome. The meeting comes in response to Pope Benedict's desire to pursue new avenues in the interfaith dialogue undertaken so far. It follows last year's letter to the Pope and other Christian leaders from 138 Muslim scholars expressing hope for greater understanding between the monotheistic religions. While some 29 Catholic experts and a similar number of Muslim scholars are participating in the forum and are expected to sign a final declaration at the end of a public session Thursday afternoon. They will meet Pope Benedict earlier in the day. President of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, Cardinal Jean-Louis Touron, told Philippa Hitchin the forum marks a new chapter in the long history of Christian-Muslim dialogue.
We mustn't exaggerate about the importance of the meeting, because this meeting, as you know, is the consequence of the 138 letter of last year. And it is a new chapter in the long history of a Christian and Muslim dialogue, an history which has been going on at least for 1,400 years, and especially after the Second Vatican Council, based on the Nostra Aetate document. So this dialogue has been strengthened at the end of Vatican II, as I said before. And since that time, there have been many initiatives, but what is important that this meeting is based on this document from the Muslim side, which is a document, non-polemical document, with great respect towards the Christian faith. For example, all the quotations from the Bible are from our sacred books, not from the Quran, and so I think there are a good basis for a fruitful dialogue.
So what kind of questions will you be looking at during this meeting? How have these topics been decided?
The topics have been chosen by a mixed delegation of both Muslims and Christians who met here together last March. I think it has been a serene dialogue, and each side will explain what he intends by love of God and love of neighbor, because the theme of the meeting will be love of God and love of neighbor. Much time has been left free for discussion and exchange. And at the end of our meeting, a joint communique is foreseen.
Dialogue between Christians and Muslims, as you say, has been going on particularly since the Second Vatican Council and Nostra Aetate. What kind of discussion are you hoping perhaps may emerge from this meeting? Will there be a change perhaps in emphasis from questions of common concern to a more theological dialogue?
Well, I should avoid speaking of a theological dialogue, but I can say that theology is always the backdrop. I think, to answer to your question, I would say that what is important is that we speak to each other, and in spite of difficulties and at times crises, bridges have never been closed. So we shall be free to discuss, I think, all the topic which will be raised by our discussion. As I said, it will be a free discussion. And so if we can do a little of theology, it would be good, but I don't know if we shall reach that level. I'm not a prophet in that sense.
How do you answer those who say that Christian-Muslim relations are still quite tense at this moment in time?
Well, I should answer that relations between Christian and Muslims depend on the political situation in the countries where they live together. And also it depends on the great ambiguity, that is to say, very often for the Muslim, the West means Christendom, and they identify the West with Christianity. So, for example, why we have this crisis and this war in the Middle East, it's always very difficult for the Muslim to distinguish between what is political and what is religion. But what I, as far as I know, what I see, religions are not the cause of the wars, of course. In every war, there is a religious dimension, but we cannot say that religion is at the beginning of these wars.
The theme for the second day of the forum is human dignity and reciprocal respect. And yet, as we know, in a number of Muslim countries, Christians do not enjoy that kind of respect. There's a denial or at least restrictions on their religious freedom. What measures does the Holy See take or are you planning to take to improve their situation?
Well, you are right to mention this very ticklish situation. I should say that the Holy See has the duty to defend the fundamental rights of Christians and of their communities. This is, of course, the least we can do. But we do that through our dialogue, through our diplomatic channels, and through recourse to the law. Because, as I said very often, we are condemned to dialogue. But what is important is that the force of law prevail over the law of force, and religions can help in this perspective.
Cardinal Jean-Louis Touraine is president of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. Well, Imam Yahya Pallavicini of Milan, Italy, is representing Europe's Muslims at this week's forum. I asked him this question ahead of Tuesday's meetings. At the end of the Muslim feast of Ramadan in September, the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue sent a message to the world's Muslims, calling Christians and Muslims to work together to safeguard the dignity of the family. Would you expect much of the discussions to focus on this common interest for both faiths?
It could be. This might be probably put into the second day session. And I feel this is a very interesting issue that the Pontifical Council has raised, because it's a practical aspect and it's also a very important common engagement between Muslims and Christians, or I'd rather say believers, in order to defend the values of relations between men and women, and especially the family relations in contemporary society.
Are there other issues that you feel should be addressed or that will undoubtedly come up in these meetings?
Well, I think that probably it could be interesting to see how we can once again find a cooperation in the fields of the relation between faith and reason, which was one of the issues the Pope addressed in his Lectio Magistralis in Regensburg, how to respond in a proactive, although critical way, to some very extreme secularistic challenges that would like to attack the sacred universal values where all believers believe in and modify society accordingly, and so find a better relation even between tradition and modernity without leading to extremism on both sides, so becoming a modernist or becoming a traditionalist. And lastly, probably some other interesting issues could be, of course, better relations and less confusions between East and West, in order to see how spirituality and universal values can help believers in the East and in the West find respect of their human dignity, but even of their faith, without any discrimination of any kind.
You have warned against the danger of a politics of secularism that, and I'm quoting partly from one of your recent speeches, interprets immigration and multiculturalism as an occasion to eliminate any historical, symbolic, and cultural reference to religion. In layman's terms, are you concerned that we are de-Christianizing Europe to our own detriment?
Well, in some terms, there is this risk. There is this risk, which is even going to be recognizable in the fact that there is a new interest on spirituality, but unfortunately, this goes together with a greater ignorance on what religion is. So you have a pseudo-spiritual approach, very sensitive to magical phenomena, to be very superficial, I would quote Harry Potter or Halloween or whatever. But on the other side, you have a greater ignorance on the two dimensions, doctrinal, symbolic, religious, historical, cultural, architectural, of how, according to a sacred wisdom, religious leaders and believers have contributed for the growth and the development of the West as well as of the East. There is a risk where somehow they are creating an artificial spiritual response which has no traditional religious roots. and they make believe that this might be a postmodern development of Western Christianity, which has nothing to do with the authentic religious Christian theology and doctrine and even philosophical development. And this crisis, if this goes at this extreme, all other religious communities as well, Jews and Muslims, will have a negative impact. And as a matter of fact, I believe that the fundamentalistic, ideological, political, Puritan, Islamist radical discourse is a emotional and a pseudo-political reaction to this risk. So we have these two extremes that are actually confusing the mainstream of believers, but even the mainstream of even non-believers that want to live in according to universal values of human rights and human dignity. I think that we have to, first of all, have a better knowledge and respect of the past and see how traditionally the development of a modern society, of a secular system, of a democracy has always tried to face and cooperate with a more ethical, spiritually oriented, wise, traditional, sacred dimension. Otherwise, we will forget the value of unity in diversity, even for concerns of pluralism of beliefs and cultures and ethnicities, and which are the values of what could be the European intercultural educational approach, and the respect of diversities without having any policies of double standards or of discrimination towards minorities or towards any other kind of differences. But on the other side, we should not confuse this open-minded, proactive approach with the need to be very firm in terms of security policies, without confusing, of course, the security of Western or Eastern civilization or Europe with any kind of religious or cultural identity. Security is something which is a must for all citizens living in Europe that want to continue to live here in accordance with the democratic system and with the freedom of expression and of religion. While persons who want to change the world instead of changing themselves are far from being coherent to their religious principles, but even to a democratic system.
Many Christians are concerned, and this would of course also hold true for the Vatican, that real dialogue between Muslims and Christians will be severely handicapped while Christians are persecuted for their faith or, as many claim, treated as second-class citizens in some countries where Islam is the predominant religion. How would you like your Arab colleagues to respond to these concerns in their meetings in the Vatican?
I think that one of the qualities of our delegation in these meetings in the Vatican is, although some of us, we have even institutional responsibilities, but we have them as theologians, as religious sensitive persons that have gone through the in-depth approach and knowledge of our doctrines. And this way we can advise institutions, leaders, political personalities to have a more sincere and honest approach in order to respect rights and duties of every citizen, also for concerns freedom of religion everywhere. So once again, probably the response we can try to contribute to do is to be honest and sincere and open to all citizens everywhere, and not have a political use of religion or to use power or politics for a personal power that is not inspiring and the social and cultural welfare of every member of its own society. In this sense, I feel that the question of freedom of religion is an issue that should start from a honest approach without any double standard anywhere. If one has to be coherent with his religious principles or with his democratic role in politics. Unfortunately, we witness everywhere the political use of religion or the extremist use of either religion and politics. which is something that as religious leaders we have to help to overcome and to even propose some concrete solutions that could help Christians, Jews and Muslims believe and behave as full citizens anywhere, regardless who is ruling and which is the religion of the state, or what are the opinions of that leader on the other religious communities or cultural identities.
Another criticism that has been made regarding progress to dialogue is that Sunnis and Shia Muslims must first resolve their own interfaith differences, just as Christians must resolve theirs, before any real progress can be made. To what extent do you feel this could weigh on progress in the dialogue between Christians and Muslims?
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm glad to say that probably one of the starting points that brought to this Common Word initiative was actually an intra-faith dialogue that was held in 2004 in Amman, in the Kingdom of Jordan, where many of the scholars that afterwards would be continuously involved in the future initiatives, such as the Open Letter to the Pope and the Common Word Initiative, were gathered. And among these, there were different scholars from different juridical schools of the Sunni tradition and Shia, very authoritative leaders, Sufi masters, intellectuals, and other personalities coming from the Muslim world, gathering on a general consensus on the authenticity of our Orthodox tradition that could not in no way lead to exclusivism one against the other within our community, or exclusivism of our religion regarding to other religious communities. So the authenticity of a universal dimension of our doctrine in the respect of inner and outer differences. And the presence within our delegation in these days in the Vatican also of this pluralism, men and women, scholars and religious leaders and institutional advisors on religious affairs of the West and of the East, Sunni and Shia, Sufi masters and so on, is contributing once again to have this confrontation with another community such as the Christian Catholics in these days, as we did with the Protestants in the former weeks and months in the United States and Yale and in Cambridge, and now with the Catholics, and once again after to have an inner confrontation, an intra-faith confrontation, where through also this dialogue with the Christians we can even go into depth to our own faith and try to solve or at least face in a more proper way the values of differences and help implement some better situations also at a grassroots level.
This week's meetings in the Vatican are just part of a series of encounters between Christian and Muslim scholars and leaders. What real, tangible progress would you like to see come out of all of these meetings together?
Well, I think the recognition of the consequence of our common engagement as believers of the unique God, which is the respect of a common dignity of religious believers of different faiths, that engaging together and cooperating together might not only deepen the spiritual values of one's own tradition, but also find inspired solutions for this positive brotherhood and finding correct responses to the intellectual challenges of this contemporary society, where I see so much ambiguity and ignorance on the primordial universal values of the spiritual traditions. And this is our responsibility, and I do hope that through this confrontation in these days, we might once again get even more inspired to work together and to implement these consequences at a more social, cultural, educational field with our students, with our colleagues, and with our brothers, be them within the Muslim community, but even with the Christian community as well.
Imam Yahya Pallavicini of Milan, Italy. Around the world, all eyes are on the American public as they go to polls Tuesday to vote for the next president of the United States, the world's only superpower. Perhaps never before have U.S. presidential elections generated so much global interest. Here in Europe, a good 6 to 9 hours ahead of the U.S., television viewers will be treated Tuesday to all-night election specials in a myriad of languages, while families, pubs, restaurants, and public meeting halls are dimming the lights to watch the coverage live. Well, in the last-minute flurry of pre-election campaigning, though, one of the issues that has not caught much attention is how Democrat Barack Obama and Republican John McCain stand on gay marriage. Does it really matter? Well, Richard McCord, who heads the Office for Laity, Marriage, Family, and Youth for the U.S. Catholic Bishops, explained to Emer McCarthy why the issue should not simply be swept to the wayside.
In the United States, most all of the legislation regarding marriage exists at the state level. So we have no one single federal law defining or governing marriage. But that having been said, there are currently two states, Massachusetts and California, that allow same-sex marriage by that name. There are 9 states that allow or recognize either civil unions or domestic partnerships of one sort or another. There are nearly 40 states, I think about 42 states when that last count, that have specific laws that prohibit same-sex marriage, again, by that name, under that title. And there are 27 states that have amended their state constitution to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman and to exclude, therefore, the marriage of two persons of the same sex or the union of two persons of the same sex being recognized as marriage. When people are asked in surveys and polls about their opinion, a little more than half, around 53 or 54%, say they are opposed to same-sex marriage. However, 40-some percent of people will say that they favor some sort of legal recognition for the union of two persons of the same sex, whether it might be some kind of partnership or domestic arrangement or whatever.
In your answer there, you quite frequently referred to marriage being known in that name. So what does marriage mean?
Marriage is essentially a conjugal union of one man and one woman. It's a union that brings them together to create a very specific and unique community. And out of that union, within that community, the two purposes of marriage are served, namely to exchange mutual love and affection, and secondly, to allow for the procreation and nurturing and education of children. Quite simply, this is what marriage has been from the beginning. This institution of marriage has a truth embedded within it. It's based upon something which is obvious to all, and that is sexual complementarity of a man and a woman. That's something that simply cannot be denied, that must be reckoned with, and that holds within it a very basic truth about the human person and about human existence, and therefore about the purpose of marriage and how it serves the common good.
Do you think sometimes that people forget why men and women get married and have children? Do you feel there's a kind of a sliding consciousness over the idea of marriage itself?
I think so, particularly in, I just simply speak for our country, the country I know best. Over the past several decades, a generation or so, there's been a blurring, a very fundamental blurring about the meaning of marriage. And I look at it in this way. I think what we have going on is a kind of contest, a kind of opposition between two ideas of marriage. The first idea of marriage is what I referred to a moment ago when I called it a conjugal union. This is our Catholic understanding and our Catholic teaching about the nature and purpose of marriage. However, that model or that understanding of marriage, I think, is being contested today by another one, and that's the model or understanding of marriage that I think of, and I simply call marriage as a close interpersonal union or a close relationship. In that model, what is emphasized is that marriage is an adult relationship that is primarily, if not exclusively, to serve the interests of happiness and fulfillment of the two adult partners who come together. It is, therefore, largely an instrumental, utilitarian kind of union that serves people's needs, that serves adult needs. And when it ceases to do that, then people are inclined to declare it to be over with. And I think we've seen the rise of divorce and the effects of divorce certainly in accord with that. So I think, yes, there is a kind of fundamental blurring or confusion that's been creeping into our social and individual consciousness about exactly what is marriage, what makes it unique, why should we preserve it as such, and why, therefore, can only a man and a woman enter it. What I'm trying to encourage people to do is simply to think deeply about the meaning and the truth of marriage before jumping to the conclusion that we ought to recognize the human rights or the civil rights of homosexual persons by allowing them to marry, and therefore really fundamentally redefining what marriage is.
A very interesting point. In one of the first public meetings of the presidential candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, in August, the very first public debate between the two candidates was on issues of faith. And the question of same-sex unions did come up, with Barack Obama saying he was for same-sex civil unions and John McCain saying he was for the preservation of the traditional idea of marriage.
Both candidates have, in many ways, quite similar opinions on the topic. It seems to me that both were saying, essentially, that they, first of all, wanted to uphold the meaning of marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and secondly, that both of them said that they also could endorse in some way other arrangements for homosexual persons. Barack Obama, for example, says that he personally believes that marriage should be between a man and a woman, but he also says that equality is a moral imperative for gay and lesbian persons. And John McCain says he thinks that marriage should be between a man and a woman. However, that it should be left to each of the states to regulate that. So I think it's still a bit ambiguous.
Does it really just come down to the difference in the meaning of a word? Is it all just in a word? Same-sex, civil unions, marriage. I mean, we understand the church cannot possibly support gay marriage. Does the church support the idea of same-sex civil unions?
It's not just a word, but it's important, I think, to emphasize that words have meanings, and that the meanings really need to be thought about deeply and extensively. I think we've talked in this conversation about the church's understanding, and it's not just the Catholic Church's understanding. It's also shared by other people, by Christians, by non-Christians, and so forth, that marriage has an integrity, has a meaning that is limited by the conjugal nature of the union, by the fact that the union is built upon and based upon sexual complementarity. Because that meaning, that truth is embedded in the reality, you don't just simply redefine it, change its name, extend its name, broaden out its name to include many other kinds of arrangements and situations in society. I think that's what we're trying to say. Also, I think it should be pointed out, too, that church teaching, and this has been expressed in several documents that have come from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and so forth, also opposes other kinds of unions between persons of the same sex that imitate, in a full and complete sense, marriage, by recognizing that union as being able to have all the rights and benefits that married people have. Because once you do that, then you basically say there's no difference between these two, and therefore the word marriage doesn't have any specific and unique meaning by itself.
Richard McCord heads the Office for Laity, Marriage, Family, and Youth for the U.S. Catholic Bishops' Conference.
And I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.